Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. So you will see that we are here in a fanciness because today is the very first episode of
our fifth season
of the fifth freaking season,
which is crazy.
Cheers.
Oh my God. Cheers.
But we also wanted to say thank you to all of you, our listeners, our friends, our families. You guys are all of them. You fill that bill for everyone.
Exactly. And it's your listenership that got us to, according to Listen Notes anyway, the top 1% of all true crime podcasts.
Correct.
That's supposedly us. Now, it doesn't matter because there are 2 million true crime podcasts.
And we're not making any cash. So.
But it sounds so wonderful, doesn't it?
It does. Now, our goal is to get to 0.5. So tell a friend.
Exactly.
Review, watch us on YouTube, and join our Patreon.
Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yes.
And I am going to put my tiara down. Are you wearing yours?
I am, but you have to wear yours. Put it on your neck. There you go.
I think I call it a tiara. I think it's a tiara. Tiara, tiara, potato, potato.
It's a tiara, but it's not on your neck if it's a tiara. It's a necklace.
It's a boa. I have a boa now.
Oh, there you go. I like it.
So thank you so much.
Yes.
We totally appreciate you guys. And
we hope we're here in another 5 years.
Thank you for putting up with us.
But right now we'll just take 6.
Exactly. True.
Today's destination is Rybrook, New York. This small village is just 40 minutes north of New York City, so with its easy commute, it is an ideal location for families who want to live there, or if you just want to enjoy a quieter life but still have all the amenities and luxuries just a short distance away in the big city. It also has an extremely low crime rate, and in fact, most years, Kath, it doesn't have any violent crimes recorded and very few misdemeanors. But in 2009, all eyes were on Rybrook when the murder of a social scion hit the headlines.
It was the end of an era. In February of 2009, Ben Novak Jr. went to check on his 86-year-old mother, Bernice. And Bernice lived in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which is where Ben Jr. lived. A neighbor had called Ben Jr. and told him that his mother's garage door had been open all night. So Ben went over to his mom's house to find a horrific scene. His mother was lying face down in a pool of blood in the hallway between the garage and the kitchen. Bernice and Ben's father, Ben Sr., were the epitome of the social scene in Miami in the 1950s through the 1970s. Ben Sr., in the mid-1950s, developed the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. And this was inspired by a French palace. So as you can imagine, the architecture and design was incredibly grand. And this is the kind of place where visiting dignitaries and presidents and politicians, and then because of that, actors and actresses would stay. It was sort of the fancy place to be, and it was absolutely unparalleled in its grandeur. It was one of the favorite hotspots of the Rat Pack. And I don't know if this was in the 50s or 60s, but it was Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin and their friends. I don't know anybody else.
And someone else.
There's a fourth member of the Rat
exactly.
Pack. And to his family, I apologize.
Yeah.
But all good things must come to an end. And in the mid-1970s, Ben Sr. had to sell the Fontainebleau because he declared bankruptcy. And then he and Bernice actually got divorced. Now, despite this fall from grace, Bernice carried herself and was treated as one of the social matrons of Miami. She was always dressed to the nines. She wasn't seen without makeup. And she was very much aware and lived her social status.
And actually, the reason that they lived in Fort Lauderdale as opposed to Miami is that after they lost the Fontainebleau, they refused to drive by it or hear anything about it. And so they uprooted themselves and moved to Fort Lauderdale.
And Bernice's home in Fort Lauderdale was just under 4,000 square feet, and she was living by herself as an 86-year-old.
It was referred to as a retirement community, and it was no retirement community. I mean, I think a lot of the people there were retired, but, you know, when I think of retirement communities, you're not living in an almost 4,000 square foot house, and she, I believe it was like 3.5 acres of land, and
oh, wow.
I mean, it was beautiful, and, yeah. And clearly of somebody of her social status.
Right, and so Ben Jr. called the police, and of course, when they arrived at Bernice's home, he told them that a week prior, she had fallen outside of a bank and wasn't quite the same. The fall had taken its toll on her, and she hadn't quite recovered. Ben Jr. was an only child, and he kind of grew up as a prince of the Fontainebleau.
With all the good and the bad that came with it?
Exactly, as you can imagine. And as a young man, seeing his father lose everything to bankruptcy and losing the beautiful Fontainebleau was extremely traumatic. It was very much imprinted on his mind the reality that nothing that we have is guaranteed, and made him understand that he had to work very hard to succeed, and he did.
And you know what's interesting about that to me, Kath, is that you hear a lot of second generations of wealthy families. Those are the kids who don't do anything.
They don't do as well as their parents.
And he definitely was not going to let that be him.
Exactly. He for sure broke the mold. So when he was just 22 years old, Ben Jr. started a company called Convention Concepts Unlimited. And he would oversee, essentially host and put on extremely large conventions for corporations all over the world. So in just over 10 years, by 2009, his company had grossed $50 million in business.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's a hard business.
Oh, I couldn't imagine.
I couldn't do it.
I could not imagine doing that. All the problems, all the complaints, all the perfection and having to put the booths where and the this. Oh, my God. But anyway, yes, it's a hard business and it's a competitive business.
And he did well.
Yes, but he aimed high.
Right.
Like he wanted larger corporations being his clients. Anyway, grossing $50 million when he was just like in his mid-30s.
Right.
Incredible. But he was also known for his hard work. However, like many people who work hard, he was also known to be difficult to work with.
And I think a lot of people assumed that this came as a result of him being the Prince of Fontainebleau, because my understanding is that he was kind of given no reins as he was a little child growing up in the hotel and could order anybody around. They had to do his bidding.
Wow.
And you should not have a child that age doing that.
Yeah, no. If your kid's like that, bring him to me. I'm going to crack him around. Yeah. As hard as he was known to work, his friends would tell you he also played hard. And one of his favorite pastimes was going to strip clubs. Turns out that's where he would meet the woman that he would fall madly in love with. Her name was Narcisa Valise, and she went by Narcy.
In 1991, now 35-year-old Ben married 36-year-old Narcy, and along with gaining a wife, he gained a 10-year-old stepdaughter named May. By all accounts, they were madly in love.
Kath, what's the likelihood of a woman working in a strip club finding a millionaire, falling in love with him, and actually marrying him?
I think we'd have about as much luck as winning a lottery.
I know, honestly. It's like that Julia Roberts, Richard Gere movie that's kind of controversial. Because
Pretty Woman.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because it glorifies everything bad about paid sex.
Yeah.
But, or yeah. Yeah.
It gives you something to aspire to.
Maybe.
Once Ben and Narcy were married, they started working together. And then as May got older, she started working in the business as well. As the company grew, and of course they were bringing in millions of dollars every year, understandably, Ben and Narcy started really taking advantage of that. They
really enjoying their lifestyle.
Exactly. They had a huge home in Fort Lauderdale. They drove luxury cars. They took amazing vacations.
Narcy-like jewelry, which
exactly.
I can totally relate to that. I love jewelry.
And I can relate more to Ben because his indulgence was Batman. And I'm kidding about the relating part. It was something that happened when he was young. He just had always loved Batman. So once he had the money, he started buying everything. All first edition collector's items, mm-hmm. toys and books and comic books and whatnot. Kept them preserved exactly as they were in several rooms in this mansion. But his favorite collector's item was a replica of the 1960s Batmobile.
Okay, now that's cool. Everything else to me, eh.
Well, why are you going to buy it and put it in a room?
But the Batmobile?
Yeah.
No, I would totally drive that thing. I mean, the Batmobile was so cool. It was so cool. I still remember my brother and I watching that, like Batman and Speed Racer. But like the 1960s, the original Batmobile, so freaking cool.
Yeah.
I would let you ride shotgun, in fact, Missy.
Could I have a shotgun?
In fact, you can.
Because we need a weapon.
You could ride shotgun with a shotgun.
We wouldn't have those, what do they call them? The belts they wore? Utility belts.
I don't know.
What, you know,
we would have their ejector seats.
Okay.
So you could be ejected and you could be like, pop, 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 pop. Yeah, no, I would totally.
Our violent natures are coming forward after all these years.
Exactly.
But even though Narcy wasn't happy with his collecting all this Batman memorabilia, because he kept them in separate rooms and she didn't have to see it, she was fine with it. But then their dream life turned into a nightmare. In the early morning hours of July 12th, 2009, police in Rybrook, New York, received a 911 call from one of the hotels. A dead body had been found in a room, specifically the penthouse suite. As police walked into the room, it was one of the most gruesome crime scenes they had ever seen. A man was face down on the ground with duct tape around his mouth, and he'd essentially been hogtied. His hands were duct taped behind his back, and his legs were duct taped right at his knee. And there was blood everywhere. It was on the walls, the pillows, the bedding, the carpeting. It was brutal. And it was very clear to detectives that the man had been beaten to death. The man was identified as 53-year-old Ben Novak Jr.
Police first spoke with Ben's wife, Narcy, because she was the one who called 911. And she explained that she and Ben and their daughter, May, were in town running an Amway convention. And there were over 1,000 attendees for this convention. And it was a big deal. So police started building a timeline. And they knew, looking at the phone records, that Ben had received a call at 6:54 in the morning. So they knew he was alive at that time based upon the length of the phone call. It was apparently a phone call from a hotel worker communicating a problem about the breakfast menu that morning for the attendees.
Which is just one of the many reasons I wouldn't want to run a convention business.
Dude, I could not imagine.
No.
1 year while my boys were in high school, I think it was 1 year, could have been two. I might not be remembering from trauma, but I had to run a mother-son breakfast and it killed me.
Well, and I believe my sister ran it one of those years too, because I had to help with the seating.
Yeah, I'm sure I roped her into it.
And everybody was like, oh, but I want to sit with my best friend and I want to sit with my best friend. I know my son doesn't like her son, but I like her.
It was the most horrific experience of my life. I knew I was the wrong person for the job. I didn't volunteer for it. They asked me and I told them this is not within my skill set, but I did it anyway and it turned out good enough. But there were complaints.
10 years later, yeah. She's still complaining.
I'll never do it again. I didn't have a big wedding. I felt like I was throwing a wedding for 4,000 moms. But anyway, it was horrible. So yeah, I can't imagine. Imagine having 1,000 attendees and you're having a complaint about breakfast or mm-hmm. breakfast isn't ready on time or whatever. Anyway, so that's what happened. So they knew that Ben was alive at 6:54 in the morning. And Narcy explained to detectives that she had been in the room when Ben received the phone call. And she said, don't worry about it. You go back to sleep. I will handle this. So she left her room at about 7:15. Because detectives found video of Narcy in the dining room at 7:17 in the morning, clearly having a conversation with hotel staff. So it was about a half hour after that video was taken that Narcy returned to her hotel room and found her husband dead on the floor. That was when she ran out of the room and immediately called 911. Because there were no signs of a struggle on the bed, detectives believed that Ben was asleep when he was attacked, and he was hit multiple times in the head. And because of how tightly the duct tape was wrapped, detectives believed that there was more than one killer. It was also noted that neither of the doors that led to the penthouse suite had been forced open in any way. It was clear that this person had simply strolled into the penthouse. So police had to look at the card key to see if anyone had used it other than Narcy to get into the room. And what they found was that between midnight and 7:45 in the morning, there was no card key usage. And they knew that 7:45, the card key was swiped by Narcy when she came back into the bedroom after handling the matter that, you know, the breakfast kerfuffle. And because of the way Ben was positioned and tied up, it was very obvious to detectives that he did not get up at any point and let anyone in. So they were wondering, like, how did the killer gain access to Ben's room? When they were interviewing Narcy, she was, of course, crying and upset, and she told them she couldn't remember if she heard the door latch behind her when she left to go take care of the breakfast problem. But she believed the door had completely closed. And of course, Kath, as you can imagine, she became totally distraught at the idea that a killer could have come in behind her, you know, that she was somehow responsible for her husband's murder because she didn't shut the door all the way. Detectives knew they had to act fast because Ben's body was found on Sunday morning, and Sunday was the day that the convention ended, and they knew that the attendees would be adiosing the heck out of Dodge. So they basically fanned out and interviewed as many people that would speak with them simply to find out if anything unusual happened during the convention that was noticed. And really, honestly, they came up with nothing in particular.
Once the convention was over, detectives headed to Florida because they knew that they needed to get additional information about the family. And Kathy, what they found out was that this was not the happy family that they pretended to be. Ben was super close to his mom, Bernice, and talked to her almost every day. And she was actually one of the officers of the company. She was listed as the secretary on the incorporation papers. I'm guessing she didn't have a day-to-day role, but they were close enough that he wanted her to take part in that too. And the biggest problem was Bernice and Narcy did not get along, which is understandable. And we had talked about this a little bit before we started recording. Bernice, even though she'd pulled herself up by her bootstraps before she married into a wealthy family, the fact is that she was this grande dame.
Oh, yeah.
And she had a reputation to maintain.
And to have her only child marry a woman that he met in a strip club. I'm sure that just did not sit well with her. And of course, she doesn't blame her wonderful, perfect little baby boy.
Petunia doesn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
And was probably most worried about what her friends would think.
Right.
What the gossips would think and what her larger social circle would think. I mean, you know that back in that era, what everyone thought of you was more important than anything else.
Oh, totally.
Especially if you had that kind of money and status.
Yeah. Lots of false pride.
And then, of course, there was May, who was Narcy's daughter from a prior relationship, who was 10 years old when Narcy and Ben got married. When May was growing up, she typically didn't live with Narcy and Ben. She was kind of farmed out to relatives and close friends of Narcy's. And it wasn't really explained why she wasn't, but that was interesting to me because everything that I read, all of Ben's friends had said that he and May had a very close relationship. She looked up to Ben as a father figure, and they were both very fond of each other. Really, the biggest problem was the relationship between Bernice and Narcy, but this was not an issue at the time of Ben's murder because, as we had said, Bernice had already passed away.
Then, out of the blue, 10 days after Ben's murder, an anonymous letter written in Spanish was received by the police that blew the entire case wide open.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Translated from Spanish, it read, "This crime, without a doubt, was committed by the wife of Mr. Novak and her brother." Narcy's brother, Cristobal Valiz, who we will be referring to as Chris, was a bus driver in Pennsylvania. So when the detectives from New York went to Chris's apartment, he invited them in, sat them at the kitchen table, and they started having a conversation. At some point, Chris gets up to
go to the bathroom.
Probably, I'm guessing.
Switch loads of laundry.
Something.
Pay the meter.
Right. So he's gone for a few minutes, and the detectives are looking at these pieces of paper that are on the kitchen table in plain view. What they are receipts from Western Union. They're receipts for wire transfers. And of course, the detectives start reading them, and then they start making notes on the name. So one name was Alejandro Garcia, and the wire was to Miami 1 month after the murder of Ben. So he was wired $500, and detectives wondered, was this a payment for a hit? You know, why is $500 being sent to this guy? Just to get a little bit nerdy on you, when you invite detectives into your home and they observe things in plain view, they do not need a search warrant. You know, had they started ruffling around the papers or digging in drawers, you know, that's probably going to be evidence that's excluded later on. But here, it was right there in plain view. Or maybe one of the detectives had blown the papers, like...
That's what I would have done. And you ruined my glass. Germs.
Blown
germs.
Them to spread out. Germs? You don't like germs? Yeah. For those of you listening, I just licked the rim of Kathy's glass. Anyway, so what they do is they notice this name, Alejandro Garcia, and they look him up and they find out that he has a criminal record in Florida. Looking at his mug shots, they also realize Garcia had only one eye. This is important because now they can go back to the surveillance footage that was taken at the hotel during the convention and look for this very distinct individual. And when they did, they hit pay dirt. They found an image on the video where Ben is walking past the camera and Garcia is not far behind.
And Kath, the other thing that the surveillance video showed was that Garcia wasn't alone as he was following Ben. There was actually another man with him. So now, of course, the police are thinking, all right, two hitmen were hired for this. Having this photo of this other man, police were able to determine that his name was Joel Gonzalez, who also had a record out of Miami and was friends with Garcia. So now with this information, of course, detectives spent months gathering evidence and they went to the usual suspects, right? They went to bank accounts and credit card accounts and anything else they could find. But really what gave them the most information and the best information were phone records. And so once detectives had the two suspects' phone numbers, they were able to track their locations to find out where they had been when they were in New York. So the trail led the detectives to a motel in Queens, New York, that showed that Garcia and Gonzalez had checked in the weekend of Ben's murder. With all this investigation 4 months after Ben's murder, detectives brought Alejandro Garcia in for questioning. Garcia, of course, denied everything. The detectives were like, have you ever been to New York? No. Have you ever stayed in a motel in Queens? No.
No. Have you ever killed anybody? No.
And after a while, Garcia was like, all right, I'm tired of your questions. And again, I'm paraphrasing. I just want a lawyer. Leave me alone. And so that's what happened. Now that Garcia's lawyered up investigators went after Gonzalez, went down to Miami.
Who, by the way, had dipped from Miami.
He did.
Yeah. He dippity-doo-dahed. He did. And then he came back. He was probably like, this looks suspicious. I better go back.
And he actually wound up eventually turning himself into the Miami Police Department. When he reached this point, Kathy, and turned himself in, he was ready to spill the tea. Gonzalez then tells detectives everything he knows and implicates his partner in crime, Garcia. And then surprisingly, when Garcia learned that Gonzalez was singing, Garcia decided to turn it into a duet.
I like that.
But then Garcia also implicated Narcy's brother, Chris. According to Garcia, Narcy is the one who opened the bedroom door and led them to her sleeping husband. Now, according to Garcia, he and Gonzalez took separate ends of the bed. They went on either side of the bed, and they actually started beating Ben with hand weights. These weren't barbells that you would expect to see men using in the gym. These were weights that women use at home.
These were like the rubber covered, right, that are thick pastel.
And, exactly. And theirs were blue. Theirs were blue pastel. That's what they used to beat Ben. They hit him so hard so many times that the body actually fell off the bed onto the floor. And then once he was on the floor is when they duct taped him and covered his mouth. But Kath, if that wasn't shocking enough information about Narcy letting them into the room, Garcia had one more secret to share. Narcy wasn't just in the room with them. She was the one telling them what to do to kill her husband. But the brutality was not over yet. Garcia said that once the three of them, Narcy, Gonzalez, and Garcia, left the room, Narcy handed Garcia a utility knife and told him to go back into the room and cut out Ben's eyes, which he did.
Finally, in July of 2010, this is 1 year after Ben's gruesome murder, Narcy and her brother Chris were arrested for their participation in it. However, the two of them were charged with not one, but two murders. As we said at the beginning of the podcast, 3 months before Ben's murder, his mother Bernice died from a fall. Well, as it turned out, a journalist named Julie Brown, who reported for the Miami Herald, and this is not to be confused with the Julie Brown who did the music video, Prom Queen's Got a Gun.
No, Homecoming Queen has Homecoming a gun. Queen.
Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun. And if you guys haven't seen it, you got to go to YouTube. It is
classic 80s.
Classic. Yes. It's so classic. Anyway, so not that Julie Brown, but journalist Julie Brown from the Miami Herald started doing research once Ben was murdered. When Julie Brown typed Ben's name into a search database, one of the first things that popped up was his mother Bernice's obituary. She did not realize that his mother had died. And so she, like any good journalist, decided to dig deeper into Bernice's death. And according to her July 18, 2009 article in the Miami Herald, the police report gave details of the condition of the home on the day that Bernice was found. According to the police report, there was quite a blood trail from Bernice's fall, and it started in the bathroom, went into the living room and into the kitchen, and there was more blood visible at the kitchen sink. Then the trail continued into the laundry room, and it was smeared throughout the walls and on the floor as Bernice was clearly walking. The trail led to the garage where her car was, and more blood was inside the vehicle. So there was no evidence of anything being disturbed or ransacked, and her jewelry was found where one's jewelry would be found.
Her purse was found, and there was no money taken from it.
Correct. Nothing unusual. So to this journalist, Julie, she thought it was rather coincidental that Bernice died only 3 months from her son. And so she decided that she was going to ask the medical examiner's office for a report, do a public records request. Well, what she was told from the medical examiner's office was that the police were still investigating and she was not allowed to have a copy of the report. She's like, that's strange. So she goes to the police department and they're like, no, we never told the medical examiner that. So now she's wondering, is there some kind of conspiracy? What's going on? Well, eventually she got the medical examiner of Broward County to release the report. which said that Bernice died from consecutive falls and she suffered extensive head injuries leading to her death. Basically, the medical examiner opined that she experienced dizziness and confusion and fell several times before she died. So one of the things that stood out to journalist Julie Brown was that Bernice had suffered a skull fracture, broken teeth, a broken jaw, and lacerations to her face. So she's like, this is really weird. The toxicology tests showed that she had alcohol in her system, but it was extremely low.
Right. More like trace amounts.
Yeah, trace amounts. Exactly. Anyway, the death was ruled accidental. But Julie thought this was an excessive amount of injuries for an 86-year-old falling. And she hit up one of her friends who was a retired police officer and said, hey, can you look at this? Can you, you know, look at this information I have and give me your thoughts?
And it was with the report came photos.
Right. Basically, he looked at it and said, there is no way this woman died from falling because there was blood spatter on some of the walls and in the vehicle, indicating a high velocity contact with Bernice. And so he said, it looks like she'd been struck in the head multiple times.
Julie Brown went back to the Fort Lauderdale police with this information from this retired officer and said, hey, I don't think this is right. And they said,
hush, hush, pretty lady.
But they basically said, it's been ruled an accident. Case is closed. Be on your little merry way.
Exactly.
But Kath, then everything changed because prosecutors were trying to work out a plea deal with Alejandro Garcia in order for him to testify against Narcy and her brother, Chris. And as part of this plea deal, which of course is tit for tat, you give us information, we'll make you a better plea deal. He revealed that Chris had paid him to kill Bernice. So Julie Brown, journalist Julie Brown, although also singer Julie Brown.
Right.
They were correct.
They.
The Homecoming Queen did have a gun. So Kath, according to court records, Nancy and Chris wanted Bernice to be killed first because Narcy wanted Ben to inherit his mother's wealth before he died. What Garcia told prosecutors is that he basically lurked on the side of the house by the trash cans waiting for Bernice to come home. When she did, before she closed the garage door, he went in and got her as she was coming out of her car and hit her in the face with a wrench. And as she struggled to leave, he hit her again and again. And that's why she had a broken jaw, skull fracture. And when she fell, you know, she broke her finger and whatnot. But this woman,
I can't imagine what that little old lady from Pasadena went through.
Agreed.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Like she had quite a constitution to withstand a blow from a wrench.
Several blows from a wrench.
And she was cruising around her house.
Right.
You know? Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Once Garcia informed Chris that this job had been done, that's when Chris sent him the money and sent him a text message that said, job well done. It was shortly after Bernice's murder that Chris contacted Garcia again and said, hey, I got another job for you. This one's in New York. And apparently, Kath, the New York job wasn't to necessarily kill Ben, but rather to assault him and somehow give him life-altering injuries. So whether it was blindness or having him be a quadriplegic,
like disable
or something,
him somehow.
Yes, so that Narcy could take over the business. And it was also to punish Ben for what she had told Chris was sexual abuse.
Everything about this case simply points to greed. What we know about Narcy and Ben's relationship is that they were into S&M. At least we know that Ben really was. So there's no indication of what type of sexual abuse Narcy was alleging that she suffered from, if at all, because it wasn't in court records.
Correct.
That we could find anyway.
Right. So Garcia told prosecutors that Chris was the one responsible for hiring him to do these jobs and for paying him, and emphasized once again that it was Narcy who was the mastermind behind this whole thing. 10 months after Narcy and Chris were arrested for Ben's murder, they were also charged with Bernice's murder.
trial began in June of 2012, and now this is just 2 years after Ben was murdered. Narcy Novak and her brother Chris were tried together for both murders, Ben's and Bernice's, and the prosecution believed with these two witnesses who had turned state's evidence, the trial was going to be pretty much open and shut. One of the detectives took the stand and said that Narcy was immediately a suspect because, although she had discovered Ben's body, one of the first things she asked detectives was, did he die of a heart attack? And the detective knew that Narcy was the first one to see the body. She saw him bound. She saw him bloodied.
And the blood all over the hotel room.
Right. Like, no, Narcy, heart attacks do not induce skull fractures. Anyway, the detective also spoke with one of the hotel guests who was in the hallway when Narcy exited the hotel room on her way to call 911. And that guest said that now she had just discovered her husband's body.
Dead from a heart attack.
Yeah. Calm, cool, collected, just sort of cruised past him in the hallway. Didn't look scared or upset. One thing I thought was very interesting was that Narcy told detectives that Ben was into bondage. And so whether she was implying that someone had come in and they would had some type of sexual encounter and he was killed.
Trust him up.
Yeah, I don't know. But the detective asked her, like, don't you think it's odd that he died in a position that you two had shared together? And
that she said was one of his favorite sexual positions.
Exactly. And Narcy simply said, when I left the room, he was not tied up. And Narcy insisted in her initial interview and subsequent conversations with detectives that she did not have any idea what happened to her husband. She had nothing to do with it. She and Ben loved each other very much. They had been married for over 20 years, and she had absolutely no idea who would want to kill him.
And Kath, despite Narcy's assertions to detectives about this warm and cuddly marriage, Ben's friends actually said the exact opposite was true, that while he may have been in love with Narcy when they got married, the fact was is that his sexual proclivities had never changed. And so living in Fort Lauderdale, he continued to frequent the seedier sex clubs. But according to these friends, Ben didn't care about cheating. To him, if Narcy was upset, that was her deal. And according to the prosecutors, Narcy was about to be replaced. Because a couple of years prior to his death, Ben had met a woman whose name was Rebecca. She was a nude dancer at one of the clubs that he liked to frequent. And much like Narcy, it was a pretty woman kind of moment, right? Ben had even moved this woman, Rebecca, from Miami to Fort Lauderdale, from an apartment to a condo even, just so she could be closer to him. And Rebecca had said this was going somewhere. He was going to leave his wife for me. Whether or not that's true, we don't know, but Rebecca believed it to be true that he was going to leave his wife and they were going to start over together. Rebecca actually also told prosecutors that Narcy knew she existed. And the reason she knew is that Narcy would call her screaming at her that that was her husband and that if Narcy couldn't have him, no one could. Now, of course, the focus of the defense was on the credibility of Alejandro Garcia and Joel Gonzalez, the actual and admitted killers, that they had just made a deal with the prosecution, so they weren't telling the truth. And then the defense dropped a bombshell. Narcy's brother, Chris, pointed the finger at his niece, May, as being the one who wanted Ben killed, telling Chris that he just had to be killed because he was an evil man. Now, that would have worked better had Alejandro not gotten on the stand and testified that in addition to Chris hiring to kill Bernice and Ben, May was the next person on the hit list. So that theory went nowhere.
And at this point, May is 33 years old.
Right. Narcy's motive for killing Ben and Bernice was just a cliche. It was about the money. It was because when Narcy and Ben had gotten married, they signed a prenup. And Narcy had agreed that if they got divorced, she would only get $65,000. Not per month, not even per year. Just a one-time payment of $65,000. And again, that's why she wanted Bernice to die first, so that Ben would inherit her estate, and then Narcy would inherit Ben's.
I think we need to insert a public service message here. All you people out there who want to do a hardcore prenup, think again. Be a little bit more generous.
Maybe have some wiggle room. And Kath, it also came out at trial that the author of that anonymous letter who first told police that it was Narcy and Chris responsible was actually written by one of their sisters.
Wow.
I know.
So after a 9-week trial, Narcy Valese Novak and Chris Valese were both found guilty of first-degree murder and 13 additional crimes, some of which were federal. So in November of 2012, they were sentenced to...
a whop.
Yes.
But because it was in a federal court, it was none of this life without parole, haha, you can apply for parole in 30 years.
Right.
Feds mean what they say, it's life.
It's life. 2 years before testifying at Narcy and Chris's trial, Alejandro pled guilty to interstate domestic violence charges in connection with the death of Ben Novak. He was sentenced to 17 years in prison and then required to pay back the $29,000 he received for being a hitman. 6 months later, Joel Gonzalez pleaded guilty to domestic violence with death resulting, stalking, conspiracy, etc., 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 and he was given 10 years. And I do not know why Garcia was given 7 more, except for the fact that he cut out his eyes. There was a movie made on this.
In 2015.
And Rob Lowe actually played Ben, which was quite a compliment to Ben.
So I'm sure that the last question on everyone's minds, though, is who got the money? So this was interesting. Obviously, it would have gone to Narcy because she was the widow.
And this was in his will.
This was his will. Even though Ben was killed in New York, he and Narcy lived in Florida. So the will was under Florida law. Florida law has what they call a slayer statute, which a lot of states have. And it's intended so that if a beneficiary of the will kills the person, the will holder, they won't get any money. So in this case, with Narcy being the killer, the law treats it as if Narcy died first. So she has no inheritance rights under this will. And by the terms of Ben's will, if Narcy didn't receive it, all the money went to 33-year-old May, and she had 2 sons, a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old. Ben's cousins didn't like that. He had 2 cousins who actually filed suit to stop this from happening because their argument was, May was Narcy's daughter. Won't Narcy benefit from May getting this money, even tangentially, because it's her daughter? The 2 cousins, they filed suit to stop it, and it worked its way through the Florida courts up to the Supreme Court of Florida, and they said, no, there's nothing that says that there can't be any connection between the recipient and the killer itself. When all this first started, Ben's net worth was estimated to be about $10 million. By the time this all worked its way through, it was about $4 million. That's the estimate of what May and her sons received.
I'm glad she received it.
I am too. All right, that's all we have. Welcome to season 5.
Season
baby.
5. Here we are. Here we are.
It's going to be a good one. Please don't
forget.
This
is the last time you see me with a boa or a thing on my hat.
Or a hat.
You'll see me with a lot of hats.
If you have cases, please send them to us because we love getting them that way. If you have not already left a review, please do. What review do you leave?
Only a 5-star is allowed.
That's all that's
only
allowed.
A 5-star.
Sorry.
Do not let your fingers do the walking.
And we have a free 7-day trial at the $10 Patreon level. So give us a try. We hope you stick around. But if you don't, you still have 7 days to listen to all the funny goodness that comes along with it, including bloopers and little videos that we do.
Exactly. So. Thanks for listening.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.